Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Network. My name is David Frank Gomes. I'm a coach and spiritual mentor. And tonight we have a very special guest. We're having a conversation tonight with a coach, author, and facilitator, Stephen Garrett, whose latest book, When Death Speaks, explores the ways we view death in our Western culture and how we can change that conversation about death from denial and fear to acceptance and inspiration. So, hello, Stephen.
Hello, David. I'm so glad to be here, and hello to all your listeners. I'm up
yeah.
for a fun and wonderful conversation if you are, David.
I am, and you know, we had a chance to chat earlier today, and Stephen generously gave me a copy of his book, so this is something new for me too. But tell me a little bit about yourself and how you actually came to write this book.
That's a wee bit of a story, but I'll give you the Cole's Notes version, David. Way back in 1988, I lost a very dear sister to a sudden and unexpected death, and so much so that her death turned my life upside down mentally, emotionally, spiritually, the whole nine yards. I used to be a stockbroker back in the day, and when Jody passed, it really shattered the foundation I based my life on. And I realized way back then that all the stuff I was striving for wasn't going to get my sister back into life. So I gave it all up and set out to serve others by becoming a social worker. And one thing led to another, and here I am writing about the very thing that woke me up, which is death.
It's incredible how people get to places in their lives and how things come up in our lives, and they seem so unworkable, and yet from that comes this incredible calling that you've developed here.
Yeah, I know, and it's interesting, David, that I couldn't have done what I did without help from some good people along the way. I was very confused, very angry, just totally out of sorts and unable to really deal with life, and fortunately found a really good coach who was able to help me make sense of the feelings I felt for my late sister Jody, help me make sense of the anger I felt towards God, help me express that very same rage I had out loud to her in a way that I felt quite relieved. And if it weren't for Anjali, my great coach, I'd still be stuck in the mire of what death had brought my way.
Yeah, it is incredible when you have that kind of support system in your life to put some of these universal events that are happening into some sort of a context that makes it meaningful and workable. So for folks who might be listening who really don't know too much about what you do, how would you characterize it, or what do you think death has to teach us in living our lives and transforming our lives?
Well, for me, I've taken an awful lot of teachers over the years. I've chased the truth or the divine or God all over the planet, from Peru to India. And what I've realized is that right under my very nose was a great teacher, because death is all around. And what I've realized in my life, David, is that we live in a bipolar planet. We have a North Pole, a South Pole, right, wrong, good, bad, light, dark, also birth and death. And our culture has been pushing death away into the morgue and into the professional realms of hospitals and into doctors' and nurses' hands, and much to our loss. What I've learned is that to which I push death away is also the degree to which I push a full and passionate life away. It's this odd marriage that it's really important to have both aspects, birth and death, to have a full and passionate, meaningful spiritual life. So by embracing death, by accepting death as it comes and being open to it, I've really opened myself up to some beautiful life lessons, which were in the form of an individual's deep regret around how they'd lived their life. So I'm finding more and more as I spend more time with those people who are dying and those family members who are losing a loved one through death, that I'm learning a whole lot about life, oddly enough.
Yeah, that's amazing. What is it about Western culture that we have become so death-denying, and we've attempted to institutionalize death and dying? Why are we so disconnected from it, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I took a very close look at that because I've always believed that the behavior of an individual makes sense if you can get into the history of that individual. So our culture is just a very large individual, so its behavior in a way must make sense if I can somehow dig enough underneath it to see why. One of the things I ran across, David, interestingly enough, was way back in the early 1800s, about 7% of us lived in an urban center. The rest of us lived on the farms. And over the years, over the last 200 years, there's been a huge migration to urban living, so much so that we've almost twisted those numbers backwards now. Mostly 89% of us live in the big cities, and about 11% of us still live on the farms. The reason I bring that up is when I was a boy growing up in Quebec, I spent a fair bit of time on my family's farm in the summer, where death was just a pretty fundamental, important, and natural part of life. The death of a pig before, you know, it becomes bacon on your table, the death of a cow before it becomes a steak, you know, the planting of a seed, its harvesting in the fall. All that stuff was very natural, very normal, and not out of the ordinary. And I think what's happened is we're just out of practice of those sorts of mini-deaths, if you will. We're out of practice with the cycle of life. Now we think that, you know, steak comes from the IGA and, you know, lettuce comes from Save-On Foods. So we're out of touch with nature, and one of the most fundamental pieces of nature, of course, is death. So the more we've pulled ourselves out of rural living or out of nature, the more we've pulled ourselves out of practicing death and dying, and not just the death of our bodies, but, you know, the death of a season or the death of a seed or the death of a harvest or the, you know, all that kind of stuff. We're just out of practice.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because, you know, in the some of the wisdom traditions, we refer to things as little deaths, and they're just like a moment arises and it passes away, or you're sitting down and stand up now, so there you're in some new place. That moment's gone, it's died or passed through a portal, a doorway into a new moment. And it also seems like we were much more intimate, weren't we? Because we buried our bodies. We had the wake and the funeral in our homes and in that rural setting. So people were much more intimate around these processes. And now they're hidden away from us.
Absolutely. You know, it was only 100 years ago that we used to lay our loved ones out in the living room by the fireplace when they were, you know, getting close to dying, when they were in this active process of death. And we would have people around them. There would be the sound of the fireplace. There would be music. There would be people talking. It was a much more graceful and community way to go, if you will. Now we send our loved ones into seniors' homes and off to hospices and off to hospitals. And there's nothing inherently wrong with any of those institutions, but gosh, we've got to remember to bring community and family along with us when our loved one is facing the one of the most intimate transitions of their lives, which we call death.
So what's it like to be working in this, you know, arena? What kind of things do you come up against? And do you find I mean, let's be honest, people must be incredulous sometimes. They must go, what transformation, what wisdom can there be in this sad moment? How do you deal with those sort of just inherently huge fears and blocks around this?
Well, I first had to deal with my own, David. And a year and a half ago, I became a cremationist at a crematorium here in Vancouver, and I had to go through my own fear of death, my body's fear of death, my spirit's fear of death, my mind's fear of death. I faced, between 8 and 12 dead bodies a day. So I had to physically get used to being around death, the look of it, the smell of it, the sound of it. It was really quite a process, and for 3 or 4 months I had a very difficult time as my body adjusted to the fact that it was seeing death so often. Because our bodies, David, are mammals, and they're programmed to survive. And when they're given evidence that they're not going to survive, it's a bit of a challenge for the body to accept that. So once I got through my own fear of death and my body's fear of death, I was then able to breathe a bit more fully and notice that along with the sadness, along with the loss, along with the tragedy, along with the bereavement and the grief and all that kind of stuff, there were also these lovely life lessons and these brilliant moments that need to be shared. And if we're able to be present and open and loving in the face of death, these moments go noticed, not unnoticed. And our own ability to live a more passionate and full life is enhanced by the wisdom that these moments of death bring us. I'll give you an example. I was a hospice volunteer over in Langley, and I had the distinct pleasure and honor of being asked to sit with an 86-year-old woman who was in the active and latter stages of dying. The staff were very busy. They were rushed off their feet, and they just felt it would be good if I just sat beside her and kind of kept her company. So she and I sat together, and nurses had left the room. I kind of hopped up on the corner of her bed, and I put her head on my shoulder and just began to stroke her hair and just be with her and comfort her physically and just help her settle her breathing down. And once she settled in a little bit, I slid off the bed and sat in a chair beside her, and we just held hands. And I just patted the top of her hand, just letting her know that there was somebody there with her. And she and I had spent some time together, so I wasn't a stranger for her. And I knew her husband quite well. He'd left that day after a long 14-hour shift, keeping a vigil for his beautiful wife. She came to her senses after she'd settled down. She said, "Oh, Stephen, you're here." I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I'd love to share something with you, may I?" And I said, "Oh, of course." And this woman and her husband had been married for, 68 years, and their love, from my perspective, was palpable. They just were deep lovers of each other. And she said to me, "Over the years, I noticed that I'd always held a little bit of love back from my husband, and I really don't think I should have done that." Well, my goodness, what a confession that she made, and I was so honored to receive it. And I just thanked her, didn't say a thing about it, and she fell off to sleep and died later that night. But when I left the hospice and I was sitting in my car, my heart was pretty raw, and because I noticed the regret she had around not loving her husband fully. What I did with her confession was I took a look at my own life, and I asked myself, where in my life am I not loving fully? And I named 5 people. My wife was one of them, where I was holding my love back from. And that night in the front of my car, I made a solemn vow to myself that thanks to this sharing of this beautiful woman, that I would in fact love those 5 people even more fully than I thought I could. So again, out of the bowels and the tragedy of somebody's death came this beautiful lesson. And those 5 people are feeling my love way more today than they were, 6 months ago when this event happened. So that's the kind of thing that when we're able to face death head on with an open heart, not denying the sadness, not denying the grief, including it, and also looking for the gift that the one who's passing away will leave behind.
Yeah, wow. That story puts a lump in my throat.
Yeah, it still puts a lump in my throat, David. And I'm just feeling for this woman that she was able to talk with me and leave with me a piece of her life wisdom that I will forevermore be happy for.
Yeah, yeah. There's that saying, the universe is not made of atoms, it's made of stories. And it's just so incredibly sacred, the work you're doing, and so beautiful for people at the most important moment in anyone's life, one could say, is the moment where one leaves the body. And to have such a compassionate and caring and present person there, which may not always be a family member even, is just so so beautiful. So, you know, it's just such a beautiful story.
And I've got tens and tens of those stories, and you know, I consider myself almost selfish in a way for working with people who are losing a loved one, or you know, working with the one who's passing on. It's almost like I get so much from them. I almost feel guilty that I haven't given them enough, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
If you like, I can tell you one more story about a family that were deeply conflicted over the mom's death, and nobody wanted to talk about it. And the daughter, who was aching to have a conversation about her mom's death, had called me up, and I was giving her some private coaching. She asked me if I'd come and sit with the mom and the dad and her sister and just see if I could break the ice that was in the room around the mom's impending death. And sometimes it requires a whole lot of love and a whole lot of directness to crack open a family that just is unable to face the fact that their mom's not going to be with them much longer. So I was sitting at the dining room table with his family, and mom walked in after having a bath, and she sat down, and I'd been chatting with the husband a little bit about hockey and just some mundane things of life and building our relationship a little bit, and talking with the other daughter about her husband and her son and that kind of thing. And the mom came in, and she sat down and smiled a little bit, kind of sheepishly and a bit shyly. And I looked at her right in the eyes and loved her up, and I said, hi, I'm the death guy. And guess what? You and the rest of your family are going to talk about your impending death tonight. I know it's going to be hard for you, but this is what we're going to do. Is that okay for you? And she didn't say yes, but she kind of nodded her head a little bit. Because I think in her heart, she really wanted to have a conversation about what was going on for her, but felt she couldn't because she didn't want to put her family through this, you know, pre-grief pain. So she nodded, and I said, okay, good. So we're going to do it for about a half hour. And then I turned to her husband, and I said primarily the same thing. I said, I bet it's tough for you, kind sir, watching your wife dying of cancer. How has it been? And all he said was, it's pretty hard. It's not been so good. And a little tear came to his eye. And then I spoke with the two daughters, and we just began the conversation. And it took a lot of love and kind of a firm hand, like, we're going to talk about this, gang. We're not going to change the subject. We have some work to do here. The beautiful thing about that story, David, is that the family were able to fully embrace their mom's death, that they actually sat about getting the will done, getting the advanced care directives handled. They talked about a celebration of her life. They talked about where she would be cremated and where she'd like her ashes placed. They actually got into the difficult yet somewhat beautiful conversation about preparing for her death. And reports have it, and the emails that were sent to me from the family let me know that she had a graceful and gentle death. And the celebration that she had prior to her death with her family and loved ones was fantastic. And that her celebration of life was beautiful and sad and rich. So the good news there is, once they had that difficult conversation, it cracked the whole family open into creating a beautiful last couple of months for the mother of the family who passed on.
Wow. It's so mysterious, this process, and to be able to enter into it consciously, with your heart open, really creates this spiritual transformation, does it not?
Absolutely. It's I think there's a university in the US of A called Naropa University, and one of the programs they offer is death as a spiritual teacher. And I totally understand that concept. I really get it. It's not that I'm, you know, wanting death to rush to my door and take me, but I'm not afraid of it, and because I'm not afraid of it, I can really learn from death. And I've been blessed with tremendous wisdom at the hands of those beautiful people who have had the intimate experience of passing on or dying. And I think, from my money's worth, one of the most sacred spiritual events that anybody can have the distinct honor of being present for.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's so few people really out there in the mainstream talking about these ideas and expressing them as you are doing. We need to shine more light on this area, don't we?
Oh, I couldn't agree more, especially for our children. I mean, gosh, children don't need to be protected from the death of a loved one. They just need to be taught what's going on. They're so resilient and so able to deal with life. Sometimes I think they're more able to deal with some of the significant aspects of life more so than their parents are. And if we're able to pass on to our children some of these, in quotation marks, death tools, I think we're doing the next generation a huge service.
Yeah, and in a way, we're creating a more peaceful world when we can accept the fact that we're born into this mystery, and then we live in a mystery, and then at some point we leave this mystery. And it's a very rare and beautiful country that lies in between. But if we don't honor the ending, then in one sense we're pretending with ourselves. And I think that's a way that forces people out of the present moment, because they have an illusion that there is going to be a future. And in fact, that's unknown.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
So I have a little sacred ritual that I do around my home. Is I have a bell at the front door, a beautiful bell that was given to me by my brother, handmade from Thailand, from some monks. And each time I leave my house, I ring that bell first, I listen, and then I look at my teacher's face. Because I don't know when I leave this room, my home, if I'm coming back or not. I assume I am. And it wakes me up to this moment, this mystery. And in a way, I feel that's kind of what you're doing for folks in your work.
That's exactly what I'm working towards over the months and years ahead, and over each day that I happen to be taking some breaths. Is, you know, you and I spoke about it this morning, David. That might have been the first and last time you and I met. My question as I was walking away from you was, did I give my gift as fully as I could to David, and was I open to receive the gift he had for me as fully as I could be? And I answered yes. So if, in fact, you and I never met again, the richness of our exchange this morning was deeply satisfying. I didn't wait till the next time we meet or next week or next month to really give you the fullness of me. I gave you all of me in the moment. And when I do that, I'm no longer afraid to die, because I'm so satisfied with the moment that I'm currently living in. And if we can help people avoid the bucket list trap. You know, you get the prognosis, you got 6 months to live, you rush to fill all of your life into those 6 months. Well, what about the first 50 years? What the heck were you doing in those first 50 years? Sitting back on your butt because you thought you had a whole lifetime.
Yeah. We have to stop taking our cues from Hollywood movies, you know, where they sanitize the mystery. And, yeah. You know, when you look out at modern materialism, you see that it has stripped away a lot of the meaning of the most important and sacred parts of our lives. And I think you're right. There's no need to wait. Actually, no need to even have a bucket list. One can just be, you know, one's life is one's bucket list at every moment. And what I find exciting is that that's a practice. It's like that's something you actually practice. And
yeah.
You become more attuned to the moment. You, in fact, are someone working with the most unworkable moments for all of us. It's like a tear in the fabric of your life, a moment
yep.
that shows up that seems unworkable, or I hate this, I don't like it. And so what would your advice be for people who are going through this process right now, who may have a loved one who's, you know, who's going to pass away, who's getting ready to leave their body?
Well, it's tough to give advice, generally speaking, but primarily what I would say is do your best to practice kindness, respect, and love when you're with the one who's passing. To be gentle and graceful, yet not shy. I mean, the one who's dying knows in their deepest heart what's up. And it doesn't help to avoid the topic with them. It's almost as if we speak about death that we're going to make it happen faster or it's contagious or something like that. In actual reality, when we do speak about it lovingly and compassionately with the one who's passing, it tends to make time stretch out in an odd way because we're just in the now moment with them. So that's what I would suggest to folks is, to the best of your ability, be as open and compassionate and graceful and real with the one who's on their way out. And don't be shy about using their name. Don't be shy about saying what you value about them. Don't be shy about talking about their impending passing and how sad you may be about it. It's the silence around the death and dying that's most painful, not the conversations.
Yeah. It's true. And I know in the case of my own father passing last year, my sense is, and you tell me if you think this is true, but my sense is no matter what, folks are always, there's always going to be some regret in every passing or every death. You know, I wish I could have done that. I wish I could have done this or said this. That's everybody's story, mine included. And so the piece to do now is to, you know, try and live your life so that maybe you'll have a few less of those regrets. But certainly, I learned that when I was lying, you know, when my father was dying and I was there with him, that I did my best to really clean everything up and make it right as best felt I could and as best he felt he could. And I really think the work you're doing helps people to clean things up in a way. I'm not being very eloquent. It's really important, I think, for people to, if they can get to that place. And does that make sense, sir?
It makes total sense. I mean, you know, my father passed about 4 years ago now, and thankfully, he and I had cleaned up a lot of our mess, if you will, or the stuff that was between us. And when Lloyd was close to death, he was able to phone me, and we had this beautiful conversation. He was plugged into all kinds of machines. He had tubes in every opening of his body. I mean, it was just really challenging for him. Lloyd was a golfer and loved life and loved to play cards with his buddies and loved to drink a rum and coke. And, you know, in the latter stages of his life, you know, he was unable to do that. His friends didn't stick around because they felt uncomfortable because he was all plugged into these crazy machines. And anyway, that, as the story goes, it was, you know, it was getting tougher and tougher for him. And, you know, Lloyd called me and said, son, you know, I'm getting the idea that I should unplug from these damn machines. If I'm going to live, I'm going to live. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die. You know, and he said, and what do you think, son? I mean, I'm his eldest son, and he's talking to me this in this beautifully blunt way about whether he should unplug himself and run the risk of dying. And I had the presence of mind to feel him and kind of be in his shoes a little bit. And I said, Dad, if that's what you need to do so that you can have a good death and say goodbye to your family well, I support you 100%. And knowing full well that if he unplugged himself, I might never see him again. And he said, great, I'm so glad you agree with me, son, because that's exactly what I'm going to do. And I said, well, Dad, before you do it and have the nurses do it, make sure you call your other kids and you have a chat with your wife. He said, oh yes, I guess I better do that too. So we had a bit of fun with it. At the same time, we had a very intimate conversation, Dad and myself, about the end of his life. And interestingly enough, before we hung up that day, Lloyd wasn't prone to say, I love you, and he was typically pretty quick to hang up the telephone. And he said, son, don't hang up the phone so fast this time. I want to be able to say, I love you, at least once or twice before we hang up. And that was a glorious ending,
wow.
A culmination of our relationship. All of a sudden, death was present, and all the history I thought was so damn important, all the things I held wrong about my dad vanished into this place, and my dad's beauty was just there. He loved me, I loved him, and that was all that was important.
Wow. Yeah, that's huge. It's huge stuff, you know. I do something in the work I do that I just call it legacy coaching, where we sort of work our way back to the ending and then figure out what we'd like people to say about us, or what do we think they might say about us, or what do we think our legacy might have been, or how has the world changed because I was in it, or who's laying there with me at the end? And it's really powerful because it really links up with the regrets that people have, that they can actually they can clean that up now. Do you get a sense that there's this with talking with people who are dying? And your hospice work, are there sort of universal regrets that come up for people that they wish they had sort of worked on more?
Oh, absolutely. There's probably half a dozen that are quite common. Surprisingly enough, one of the top ones was most people regret that they didn't share as fully as they could the happiness they felt in their body. What that says to me is most people feel pretty happy that they're alive, but they just forget to share it. And they regret the fact that they didn't exude more happiness given the life that they were living. Another one that's very common, David, is that people regret the fact that they didn't live their life their way, that they tried so hard to fit in that they actually fit themselves out and lived somebody else's life, hoping to gain their approval or their love or their friendship. So there was a deep regret around not living the life that they knew they could live. And of course, there's the common ones, you know, I regret not spending as much time as I could have with my loved ones and my family. Interestingly enough, David, nobody's ever spoken to me about, I wish I had made more money. I wish I had worked harder at the office. I wish I had had 5 BMWs instead of just one. Nobody talks like that at all when their death is present. they do talk like those regrets I just identified for you.
And the interesting thing about those regrets is they are so workable. I mean, you know, that's the work we're doing in coaching, is like helping people to find themselves again. And so I guess you could say that a successful spiritual life is one where you come to the end, you don't have those kinds of regrets, that they are... I guess we're all going to have a few regrets, maybe. You know, that's life. I can understand that. But so many of the things you've talked about, there's actually an antidote for those.
Yep, and that antidote may well...
But only the living get to...
I was just going to say, David, maybe that antidote could be facing death head on. You know, that exercise you just spoke about, the legacy work, that's primarily what you're asking people to do, is go to your deathbed and look back and let your death, based on the way you're currently living, inform your life so you change it so you don't have those regrets when you die. It's a masterful piece of work that you're doing, David, and those clients that you're doing it with should be thanking their lucky stars, because that type of approach is where real growth takes place, where real freedom takes place. Because we all know we want to die well, we just kind of forget about it and put it in the back burner.
Yeah, it's hidden away in a little compartment. And in a way, you know, we were speaking about it earlier today, but... people who are dying are wisdom holders in that they no longer have an agenda. Their only agenda is, please, I'm at the end of this mystery, but there's still time for you. These are some things I have learned about the living of life, on the fact that it's finished for me. I believe that is the single biggest regret spiritually for people, is that they feel they haven't really lived.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is something the dying can teach us.
Yeah.
And they want to teach us.
Absolutely. All we have
just,
to do is a bit more time with the people who are dying, i.e. get your butt into a senior's home.
Yeah.
And, spend some time with folks who are close to death. And when you spend time with them, spend the bulk of your time listening to what they have to say.
Yeah. And that's on a personal level, you know. There's great rewards in doing that work for yourself, because oftentimes you notice that... especially with seniors, you know, I'm not talking about people that have died young, but with seniors, they often have little connection anymore to the outside world. Often many of their family are gone anyway. So it's unbelievable how rewarding it is when you're able to sort of share a portion of their life with them. As a filmmaker and somebody who's done legacy films, I know how critical that is. People want to tell their story before they leave. And it's such an honor to have to be the person who's being told this magnificent story. And then I also think we talked about this a little bit briefly. It's like the work of taking some of these institutionalized areas and bringing more humanity to the process, hospitals, hospices, doctor's offices, cancer clinics. You know, what a revolution we could create if we could get in there and help people to realize that there's something sacred going on here. It's not all bad news.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a revolution that I'm very willing to be a full part of. And if I have to offend or disturb somebody's sense of life, I'm very willing to do that, because the richness that comes from being with those who are passing is well worth the risk of upsetting a doctor or a nurse or a hospice worker or two. So I'm totally up for that that revolution. And it doesn't take much to begin.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a matter of fact,
well, we have to wrap up here. Sorry?
I said, as a matter of fact, David, you and I may have begun that very revolution here tonight.
Yeah, well, you inspire a couple of revolutionaries, spiritual revolutionaries. All the great social movements, the wisdom traditions. I don't think of Buddha as just a teacher. I think of him as a revolutionary. He came during a time, and he taught a revolutionary approach to finding enlightenment. Any final thoughts you want to put out there around this work, what death speaks and death and dying?
The only thought I'd leave your gang with is the fact that we've done the Grim Reaper trip, and it's time for a rebrand. And I'm rebranding the Grim Reaper to be an inspirational teacher. And if anybody would like to share in that journey, all I got to do is check out my website, embraceyourdeath.com. I'll say that again, embraceyourdeath.com, and come join the revolution.
Yeah. And we've posted your website on the write-up here so people can click on it. And if they want to buy your book, and I recommend that people pick it up, When Death Speaks, Listen, Learn, and Love. How can they do that on your website?
They can do that on my website, or they can go directly to chapters.ca or amazon.ca and just punch in When Death Speaks, and up will come the book. And I'd be very happy if they were to do that.
Yeah, me too. Stephen, it's been a real honor and a privilege to talk to you tonight about this you're doing. It's sacred work, it's important work, and I'm thrilled that we've connected and that I've had an opportunity to just scratch the surface a bit about this incredible stuff that you're doing. It's just the folks that get to work with you are very lucky people.
Oh, thank you so much. I actually consider me the lucky one, but thank you, David, and I look forward to our growing and budding relationship, and I look forward to being with you again on radio and also off radio out in the community.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the great thing about transformation. You know, it shows up in two ways. It's always humble, and you never really know who's giving and who's receiving. You just know that something beautiful is happening, and that is the work you're engaged in, and that's the kind of person you are. So, for everyone who's listening, my guest was Stephen Garrett. When Death Speaks is his new book, Listen, Learn, and Love. Thank you for listening, and we will see you in a couple of Mondays from now, where we'll have another conversation about transformation and human consciousness and happiness and how we can live a more meaningful life. So thanks for listening, and good night.